if business looks to further its objectives with technology in a way that's aligned with what's good for humanity, which there's plenty of ways in which that can be true, then as business succeeds, it will bring humanity with it.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today you are in for a treat because we have in the studio Kate O'Neill, and I know a lot of you probably have read her work, but for those of you who haven't and have been living underneath a rock for a while, so she's provided expert commentary about the impact of technology on live international news, such as, you know, small things like the BBC World News. She's offered expert input for major newspapers such as the New York Times, maybe you've heard of it, and some viral editorials for outlets like Wired. So I could go on, and I will with her. But she actually has written a number of different books that on very different topics. So I think that I love speaking to her because she is a little bit of a futurist. I don't know if you noticed, but the podcast is called Future Proof. And I think that she has visionary views on the future of meaningful human experience. And I wanted to talk to her about what it means to be a tech humanist, what is the future of innovation, what it looks like, and what human-centric digital transformation really is all about. So, Kate, welcome to Future Proof.
Thank you. That's such a fun intro.
Yeah, well, it helps that all of it's true. And I think that it's really nice also to sit down with you. True or false? This is the first time we've recorded this episode.
False.
Yeah, I just want to point out that we had audio issues the first time. So if Kate knows what she's talking about today, if she knows what she's talking about, it's probably because she did the first time as well. But obviously,
so you're saying I cheated.
You cheated a little bit, but she is one of the more eloquent people that I know in general. So I think that you guys are all in for a treat. And I wanted
Thanks for setting the bar real high. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I really wanted to start out by talking about what is innovation and what is it not, right? Because it's one of those buzzwords that we're hearing so much about now. And I feel like obviously it's always been around as a word, but it's become so sexy recently that everybody talks about it without having a clear understanding of what it is.
Yeah, you know, I think it's funny because it always does seem like there's a tendency to go toward innovation being about just what's novel, what's new, you know, what's coming. But I think what it means to me is an extension of the idea of meaning in general, meaning being one of the most human components of life. And when we think about meaning, it always comes down to what matters. Meaning is about what matters. And as I point out, innovation is, you could extend that to say, it's about what is going to matter. So I feel like innovation is about looking at what's going to be meaningful in the future, not just, you know, what's new and what's different, but how does this affect humanity? How are we going to, you know, be changed by whatever this thing is? That's where I come down on that.
And I really love that in your last book, you were talking about how to actually not have technology overrun what makes us human, and how to actually use technology to be better humans, and how to maybe dive into it and just kind of tell us the whole process of how you went from manifesto to full-on book, because I think that was also very interesting to hear about.
Yeah, thanks. It was a cool process. I challenge everyone who's listening to this, really, that, you know, you should really write a manifesto every once in a while, because I think we sit around with ideas and biases.
I don't know if you realize how many people listen to this. We're going to have a crapload of manifestos out there.
I think we should. Everybody should write their own manifesto, because I want to, and I would like to read them. I want to know what people are most passionate about, what they firmly believe, you know, is wrong with the world and should be better. I think if we channel that part of ourselves, then we have a better tendency to come up with, you know, what's meaningful to us. So that was what, you know, I've done this every once in a while. I wrote a few years ago, I wrote the Meaningful Marketing Manifesto or something like that. And then, a few years ago now, I wrote the Tech Humanist Manifesto. And the idea was, you know, we have so much emerging technology. We're talking so much about the Internet of Things and about blockchain and automation, AI, and so on. And it just feels like so much of that is a tech-led discussion. It's not about, you know, where humanity sits in all of this and how this is going to affect us as the world around us becomes more data-driven and tech-driven. So it really felt like the emphasis needed to shift. It needed to switch, and we needed to start from the place of human centricity and start thinking about, like, what is it that we're trying to accomplish in the world? What makes us human? What makes us thrive as a human, as a people? And then what can the technology around us do to make that better? How can it amplify that for us? So that was the gist of it. And I got a really great response to that manifesto. One thing I got was that one of the greatest pieces of feedback was from a guy who is a vice president at the Computer History Museum in the Bay Area. And he said, you know, we've been sort of searching around for what our mission is going to be going forward, because obviously by the name of our organization, you can tell we think a lot about the past of computing, but we know that there is a big future for computing, and we don't know what that's supposed to be for us. And you just articulated what our strategy and mission is now going forward. So I felt like that was such a moving, profound moment for me that it resonated that much that an organization that's that steeped in the relevance of technology to culture and humanity was going like, this is it.
And he immediately Venmo'd you $1 million, right? Oh,
yeah, yeah. And my life has been so much better ever since.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I think that you're right. It's something that, as an author, just to speak about myself for a second, because when you find out that you have an idea that has been able to spread and impact somebody in some way, that's really why you do it. It's not for that many other reasons.
Or the $1 million that you get Venmo'd. I mean, that's...
Right, exactly. If you're J.K. Rowling or somebody of her ilk, then maybe things are different. But if you're a business author, then you're already marketing to 1% of people who have an interest reading to sleep, I guess.
I just don't want to discourage the Venmoing of the $1 million if anybody out there is so inclined.
Yes, absolutely. we'll put Kate's Venmo ID in the show notes. So let's do a very quick lightning round of irreverent, slightly off-topic stuff, okay?
Sure.
So one of the things I was most curious about was, well, first off, how many times do you think you've spoken publicly right now?
And we're talking about like a public presentation, right?
Yes, not just in some
how
way.
How many times have I uttered words
not
in
just
public?
Going to Starbucks and ordering Americano?
I don't know. It's several hundred. I don't know how many it is, really. So there's a process that speakers go through if they want to, which is to become a certified speaking professional. And in order to become that, you have to have 250 paid presentations. And they all have to have, you know, some things in common and things like that. And I'm not quite there in terms of the paid, consistency of my presentations. But it's several hundred, and it's probably more than 250. It's just that they're not all at the same consistent level. So yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And I think it shows a lot of, you should show a lot of respect to the speakers that you meet who are certified speaking professionals, because man, that's a whole lot of work to go through.
Yeah, I like that, where Kate's like, I'm about to be there, and once I'm there, y'all got to respect me.
And Venmo me that $1 million.
Yeah. what's something that you've never really admitted about yourself in an interview before?
I don't know. I've never recorded a podcast episode in the middle of a comedy club before.
That is true. We are recording in a comedy club, and you can't really...
you can feel the funny. I bet you can.
I think you can feel the funny. I think it's... the amount of people who kind of come through here, and that's why we figured what better place than to have a serious show on futurism than in a comedy club, right? Because it is kind of folly to try to predict something that will happen in the future, but I think, honestly, that the more... evidence you have, the more information you have at your disposal, you can do a better job at it. So
sure.
Why not?
Yeah.
Which number employee were you at Netflix? And are you surprised by how successful the company has been? Because people have said that it might actually make it as a company.
Yeah.
It might be the next blockbuster.
I don't know exactly what number, but I was within 100. I was one of the first 100 employees at Netflix. And I am not super surprised, because it was always an exemplary kind of company. Like, there were so many good decisions being made all the time. Like, I joined the company when they were still, they were renting DVDs, obviously, since we were early days. But I don't know how many people know that they didn't always do the subscription model of DVDs. Like most people who are familiar with their DVD rental know the queue, you know, the whole thing where you would have the subscription and you'd send one in and you'd get one back and everything. But they didn't have that from the beginning. They were renting DVDs a la carte, and then they figured out the subscription model. And as soon as I saw that model, I was just like, they're onto something. I totally want to be part of this. And I reached out and was just like, if you can figure out a role for me in the company, I would really like to be a part of it. And they did. So it was a fantastic time to be there. They were just sunsetting that a la carte rental program and really going sort of doubling down on the subscription model. So even from that point, I was just like, you know, they get it. And by 2000 or so, Reed Hastings was already making investments into R&D for what we would then talk about as set-top boxes, which were the predecessor to what we now know as streaming. Mm-hmm. And so, like, this is 2000. The first Rokus didn't come out until 2006. There wasn't a dedicated streaming plan on Netflix until 2007. This took a lot of visionary planning and investment on his part, because we're still in the middle of an all-out bloody war with Blockbuster at that point. So I just look at those kinds of decisions and I think, like, no, it's not surprising that the company is successful and probably will continue to be successful. They've just always shown that kind of visionary leadership.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Being able to see something before other people do, and even seeing that it's a possibility, means you can start aiming in that direction. And if you don't even see it's a possibility, well, then sure, it might not actually happen.
Yeah, and it's tough because you look at that kind of that sort of example and think, you know, he had to have been able to see what you, like as you say, that see it's coming, but also be so invested in the current model of their business to be able to win against Blockbuster as cleanly as they did. So it's a, from a leadership perspective, I think of that a lot. You know, whenever I'm faced with kind of making decisions about my business or about the direction of industry or whatever, you know, how do you kind of keep one eye on the future while also keeping one eye very focused on the now? And it sounds like it would have you very blurry with your vision, but I think that's a real challenge for any leader, any CEO or leader of a company to be able to do that.
Yeah, I like that. And we're going to skip my last question because it was, which member of the Trump administration would you most want to sleep with? But I feel like we're going to run out of time if I ask that one. So I'll just skip that one. So I want to move on actually to talk about human-centric digital transformation as an idea. You know, can you clarify what that is and why that's so important?
So going back to, you know, the premise of that, the Tech Humanist Manifesto, it was so much about how a lot of the discussion we have about digital transformation and about where technology is going starts from the thought of the technology itself. And it thinks it starts from the premise that technology is just interesting, right? Like that we should always be pushing forward on whatever the opportunity is to use new technology. And not so much from the standpoint that there are ways in which humans can be, you know, enhanced, or our lives can be enhanced, rather, that our values can be amplified, that, you know, the things that we care about and the things that are meaningful to us can be brought into greater clarity or made easier to access or whatever by technology. And I think what is cool for businesses from a digital transformation standpoint, if they start from this human-centric orientation, is that they can think about what the company actually exists to do and how it connects with humans outside the company, right? Like, what are the people outside the company trying to accomplish that intersects with the purpose of the organization? And once you have the clarity of that, you can use data to model that, and you can use technology to amplify that, and you can get to a point where you're more streamlined, you're more efficient, you know, you're more future-ready with those digital transformation decisions. But I think if you start from the standpoint of, hey, what technology can we invest in that's just going to make us faster or more profitable or whatever, you're sort of missing that starting point that really gets things oriented.
But also, okay, yeah, I agree with you, but I would also challenge you, and this is something I don't have the answer to, but let's just say if you're a company that's starting a new platform, or if you're a company that wants to invest in a new technology, I think that it's not that difficult for a lot of people to say, and here's what I think that the short-term outcomes are going to be of making that type of strategic move, right? But how do you have the foresight to then say, and then it's going to lead to this, and then as a result, this will probably happen, and this will probably happen. How do you avoid creating a monster and basically have the human in mind, not just for what's going to happen for the next 6 months, but also, you know, like 5 years down the line, and at least having a hypothesis that the only good things will come from this, or largely good things will come from this.
Yeah, I mean, you can't anticipate all the consequences, and I mean, they're called unintended consequences for a reason, right? But I think we have to be as intentional and clear in our planning as possible, and I think the orientation of thinking about the human and thinking about how the decisions we make affect humans and how they affect culture and how they affect, you know, our experiences writ large and our interactions with other people, like those are the considerations, I think, that help us in making those strategic and planning kind of decisions with companies as we're making digital transformation decisions. So even thinking about things like, you know, the example we were talking about with Netflix, where, you know, going from the DVD program to the streaming program, you know, with streaming, we brought about this whole cultural transformation of binge watching. And, you know, this is arguably not a good cultural transformation. Like we're all sitting on our couches a lot more than we probably were before, or maybe not, you know, but we have these new sort of modalities of how we consume content. And that was largely introduced by the advent of streaming entertainment. And I think, like, you know,
I'd say social networks also are, yeah, you have to feed the beast. Have to, if something is based off of a subscription model or even an ad revenue model, you've got to keep people there. And if you've got to keep people there, well, then how do you make that happen?
Sure.
And then is that good for the company? Sure. And that's good for, let's say, a few, you know, tens of thousands of people might work for that company. But is it good for, well, if you're serving 10 million people, then that's where, you know, it might not be good for society writ large.
Exactly. And that's kind of the pros and cons of the discussion, that, you know, you sort of have to have that bigger picture consideration set somewhere in the planning and be able to say, like, you know, maybe this is going to, if it's wildly successful, this is one of the questions that I have executives, you know, ask themselves, and designers and strategists as well. What happens if this is wildly successful? And you have to try to think about the ways in which things might fail and the ways in which things might succeed, you know, unexpectedly. And you have things like, I often talk about Amazon Go as an example of this, because Amazon Go, the retail store that doesn't have any cashiers, where you just walk through a gate and you're scanned in and you don't ever have to check out your items that you're buying. They also have in their onboarding the tutorial that on the app that you use to shop there. It says, since everything that you take off the shelf is automatically charged to you, don't take anything off the shelf for anyone else. And I always use this as an example of, like, well, that's an unintended consequence. It will be an unintended consequence, because how many of us have ever not had someone ask for help at a grocery store, right? But what happens now if we're discouraged from having those kinds of interactions? And, you know, it's a little hyperbolic to say, like, oh, all of a sudden that's going to mean the change across technology or across culture, where we don't interact with each other, or we don't ask for help. But I think those kinds of things do add up. And the point is, experiences at scale do change culture, because experiences at scale are culture.
Yeah, and I think mobile phones are a perfect example of that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this thing that, oh, great, it'll help you find your way when you're lost, and it'll do this and it'll do that. And you're right, there are all these really good things that come from it, but there are all these bad things. Like, if it's really fun to walk down the street and just take pictures of people walking into stuff. I always have enough time to stop them from hitting something, but I'm like, but I don't have time to stop them and warn them and also get the picture.
Right.
So I have to make
trade
a decision.
Off somewhere.
Right. And you see this stuff all the time. And unfortunately, you're right. Like, you, for a lot of these things, once, I feel like it's like Pandora's box, once they're out in the wild, there's no way to say, you know what, after further review, we have determined that there is more harm than good in Facebook for society, and right. we're going to pull the plug on it, right? So, I mean, are we just living in a world where you're going to see more and more things that might not be good for us just get out there and never get put back in the box?
Yes, and a lot of those things are going to have some net good too. I think this is where my framework is always both and it's always that, you know, we're not going to be living in a complete dystopia or a complete utopia, right? It's going to be pieces of each, and we have to be able to accept that the good things that come from different kinds of technology being present in our lives also bring about some bad things or some trade-offs. And we just have to work to be as intentional and as clear and as forward-thinking as we can in the planning and the execution of those things so that we can anticipate how they affect human experiences.
And I just thought of the name of your next book. You ready?
Okay, what is it?
Dysutopia.
Dysutopia?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm writing it down.
Kate is writing it down. I just was thinking, what is in between a dystopia and a utopia? And some people might say the answer to that is New Jersey, but I actually thought that maybe there's like a new word that can come out of that. So I don't know.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. I like New Jersey, by the way, for what it's worth, because they have a lot of Sonic drive-ins. But
and Wawa.
And they, oh my God, don't get me started on Wawa. Otherwise, people will be like, it was a great episode, but then he talked about Wawa for 45 minutes, and I got really confused. So I wanted to kind of, you know, dovetail back, you know, to the tech discussion, because I think one thing is it's not really necessarily one technology, but there are a number of different technologies that can be lumped into the general idea of automation, right? And I mean, I'm personally, this is an example where I'm like, oh, I'm concerned and I'm not concerned, you know, kind of like your mm-hmm. yes and right. or but and. Because I think that automation opens up a lot of opportunities because there will be people that won't do work that they maybe don't really want to do, and that will then force them to become more educated, which will then force more access to education in order to keep all these people busy. But I don't know, how concerned are you with regards to automation? Are you a Yang Gang type of mentality where, like, we're, you know, all going to need a lot of government money because there's going to be like four jobs and we're going to get in a, you know, fight club to try to figure out who's going to get those jobs or what?
No, and I think universal basic income is definitely a model I think we need to experiment with, and we need to see, you know, kind of how that plays out. But I don't see that as really the be-all, end-all solution. I think there are always going to be too many inequalities that's just going to foster. We already have too much inequality, and what, you know, wealth inequality is distribution of power is too jacked. You know, it's too much concentration in one set of hands. And if you've got, you know, pretty much everybody on an enhanced Social Security, and you know they're not making a productive contribution part of the decision making and part of the power structures, there's still going to be people who have all the power. And I don't necessarily see where we get to a dysutopian state that way. But I think, you know, it's going to be part of the model. I think there's going to have to be, you know, some experimentation with that. We're also going to have to figure out, you know, if there are human-to-human networks that channel value in different ways, if we're going to have sort of the artisan craft, you know, kind of handmade thing, if that's going to become part of where we attribute value, if there's like more of an emphasis on trade, you know, we'll see. I think there's going to be a lot of things we'll experiment with over the coming years. But I'm a little nervous about, yeah, automation. I have a love-hate relationship with, just because I think the amount of good that it can do, again, you know, it's both and, right? Like, it can do a lot of good for us. It can certainly relieve a lot of mundanity, and it can get us.
Is that a word?
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
It's not dysutopia.
We'll put it in the show notes if it's a word or not.
It's not going to be the name of my next book.
Mundanity, yeah.
But anyway, I guess the other thing is that, you know, obviously we are talking about a massive amount of job displacement, replacement, and massively augmentation. That's the main thing, and we don't know what that looks like yet. But some creation, too, and we'll see, you know, how that takes shape. So It's a very kind of like, we don't know what to think of it yet, but I just think we haven't shown, I think, culturally, governmentally, you know, corporately, we haven't shown a whole lot of ability to be proactive about the types of things that are causing massive change to, like, human scale, right?
Yeah, and by the way, that actually, this is how I feel like it dovetails into your whole entire equality, you know, discussion, because if you just tried to make a, you know, if you try to judge this off of dollars, right, and you said, mm-hmm. well, it has caused, let's say, $50 billion of suffering, But it's also led to $15 billion of new money in the market. But then you realize that, wait, but of that $50 billion, one person has $43 billion of it, let's just say. Then it's not having a positive net impact. There's only so psyched to be alive that some people can be, right? And as a result, once your happiness level is a 10, then it just, from a logic, if our job is to, and I think that in some ways innovation is to maximize the happiness of the average person in the world.
Is that your definition of innovation?
I think that innovation certainly has to move humanity in the right direction, overall. And happiness slash satisfaction and content in whatever word you want to say. Yeah, I think that if innovation, if you have some innovation that just basically leaves everybody worse off, or if for every one person, it puts in a better place, it puts eight people in a really awful place, then I don't know if that necessarily qualifies as innovation in my mind. Maybe technically it does, but I don't know if it should.
Yeah, so here we come back to, this is what I articulated in the Tech Humanist Manifesto, and it was part of the guiding principle of the book Tech Humanist, is there's an inordinate amount of capacity and scale that emerging technology brings with it. And business is the driver behind the advancement of technology. So what we need is for business to be able to align its motives with what's good for humanity and use technology in alignment with, human outcomes. So if business looks to further its objectives with technology in a way that's aligned with what's good for humanity, which there's plenty of ways in which that can be true, then as business succeeds, it will bring humanity with it. But if it's isolated, if it's not in alignment, then we're not going to get to where I think we actually can. I think there's a chance that we could get to a place where we are creating the best futures for the most people. That's what really the power of automation and AI and all these other emerging technologies really are, if they're put to good use. We're just not going to get there if there's not alignment between business objectives and human outcomes.
Right. And I think that I kind of come back to the whole putting the genie back in the box, analogy is, right now we have a situation where there are things that maybe get created, then you realize that they're bad, and then you're like, oh, you can't just say my bad. Society has been changed in one way, shape, or form, and it's very difficult to go back. So, I mean, we frankly are great at that. And I mean, you'd be the first to probably acknowledge that it's nothing new, but I think that probably the first nuclear weapons were things that's a perfect example where, you created something arguably for altruistic reasons to try to, stop a war, or I know I'm paraphrasing from history, but then, obviously if you look at the history afterwards, then there were all of these unintended consequences. So this is a long way of saying, is this just part of, from your experience in, studying and researching this, is this just part of humanity where we're constantly going to be these people who are, these individuals who are innovating in ways that that don't actually benefit us long term? Because if you look at like a lion or a tiger, they're just kind of hanging out and they're generally not doing things that then 400 years later, lions are like, oh crap, why did we do this?
Well, they use tools, right? One of the things we know about non-human animals is they do use tools. We just don't know how sort of forward thinking they are about the use of those tools. So as far as like strategy and planning goes, that's mostly in our domain, I believe, at this point. So yeah, I think it's probably part of the human condition that we're always trying to change our environment or, improve upon it, hopefully. And we often fail, or we often create situations that are at least complicated, if not a failure of trying to improve upon them, right? So I keep coming back to, it's always about the both and to me. It's going to be the things that we create, the things that we introduce into the world are going to both add, measurably to our happiness, to the meaningful fulfillment of our lives. You could say this about social media, and they'll deteriorate. They'll have, deleterious effects as well. And I feel like social media is one of those things, right? Like, you can think about the ways in which we connect with other people, that it's so much easier to find your, quote unquote tribe, to people that you have affinities with, that you would never have been able to find those people before social media, and to really bond with them. Of course, there's also the downside of, the sort of addictive behavior of of social media and all of the many ways in which we're being spied upon and preyed upon in the advertiser model. So there's pro and con, right?
There's also a lot of research on this, and this is true, that basically indicates that humans who are a little bit more paranoid or looking for the problems are the ones who tend to stick around longer. They were more likely to procreate historically, and that's why we are actually, when you take something like social media, the average person who is a pundit is more likely to be incentivized, but also to think about critically about what is wrong with it versus, you know, like you don't have generally like the weather, for instance. I mean, the weather becomes a really great story when there's something wrong with the weather, when there's something really bad. But you never have a thing like, you know, you're joining us now for our live ongoing coverage of arguably the nicest day in October ever, right? It never happens. So I think because of that, I mean, this is just, given you know, we're talking about human nature, I think it is our human nature to focus on all of the bad about social media, and there is tons of bad, but that doesn't mean there's not tons of good that arguably, you know, outweighs all of those negatives.
Yeah, and I think we can't have that one. We can't have one conversation without the other. If we're talking about how we can use like AI to benefit humanity going forward, and there are plenty of ways that we can do that. You know, it's already been shown to be better at diagnosing cancer than human physicians and radiologists. It's already been shown to be effective in certain kinds of deployments around cleaning up the environment and looking toward climate change improvements. You know, so certainly AI has a role to play in improving life for us on this planet and the quality of our human lives. But we can't have that conversation without also talking about algorithmic bias and without talking about all the ways we've gotten some of the pieces wrong so that we can correct some of those things to the extent that we can, and so that we're aware as we go forward about all the things that we are building upon that are somewhat flawed, and that we can make the future as good as it can be, knowing that some of the pieces we're using are a little dented and broken, and we just have to do the best we can.
I like that. Make the future as good as possible, knowing that the pieces you're working with are a bit dented and broken. That's actually how my wife describes our marriage. So, I mean, I think that just kind of, you know, and I know that we got to let you go soon. I want to ask you one or two other questions. Given the fact, I mean, people can talk about whether or not they're an optimist or pessimist, but I know that part of your job is to have a vision for where the future can go, but also, I'm curious, what realistically do you think is going to happen with some of the things that we're talking about now? Do you think that I'll just shut up and listen to you?
Yeah, you know, I think we know already that some of the job displacement and replacement are really going to happen. And that, you know, we know that that's going to affect, for example, people in certain industries and certain job types more than other people immediately. So truck drivers, for example, and cashiers and people working those kinds of jobs are much more at risk of having their jobs be replaced by self-driving trucks and things like that. So we need to be aware of that. We need to be wise to it. We also know that there are demographic profiles to people who hold those jobs, that they're disproportionately people of color or people who are already living on the margins in some way in this society. So it's a really unfair way that this is going to come down. So I think we need to be having that conversation eyes wide open as part of this discussion about the emergence of technology. So I think that, you know, the way I see things kind of playing out is there are going to be some very, very cool conveniences that are going to be afforded to us by different kinds of automation. Some really fun, like we've seen the emergence of a lot of available content and entertainment options and stuff that are driven by algorithms because they know how to make good recommendations to us. They know how to show us affinities. That's all going to be true, too. So we'll have all of this good and all of this bad happening in sort of sequence with one another. And we have to figure out how to make the best of those pieces where how do we figure out what jobs we can put, you know, the displaced truck drivers into? How do we, you know, create the right kind of pipeline for those people when we have an imperfect system at this point for you know, a universal basic income or Social Security or something like that. We're not there yet. We don't understand what that macroeconomic picture of that looks like.
Right. But we do. I mean, the good news is that I feel like we have people like you who are thinking about that and trying to imagine those unintended consequences so that we can address them in some way, shape, or form beforehand.
Which we do.
I mean, that's important because if you don't, for instance, the things that you're calling out mm-hmm. are very important and there aren't enough people that are pointing out the more obvious, you know, short-term mm-hmm. consequences that we have to be thinking about now and not let's wait until something that a lot of smart people can figure out will occur. Let's try to address it now as best as we can.
Yeah. And what's really encouraging to me is that when I talk about these things in audiences of like corporate leaders, for example, a lot of them come up to me afterwards and they are really encouraged. They're really hopeful about how their companies are going to be able to, you know, make better decisions going forward. And, you know, I think a lot of people are really cynical about, you know, how corporate leaders think about this kind of thing. Like, they're like, well, but are they really going to make any changes? And I usually find that people are people, right? We all want to be part of doing the right thing. We just have to work with the incentive structures that are in place. And I think we need to be able to change those incentive structures when we know that they're flawed. And I think a lot of the corporate incentive structures, as far as rewarding pure profit, you know, seeking growth, that is not necessarily in alignment with making sure that those company objectives are in the best alignment with humanity. And that's what has to change.
And that can be a whole other episode on capitalism. But, you know, and it's true. I want to leave you with, I guess, like this one last question, because this is something I like to ask people who are tasked with getting the future right on an ongoing basis, right? Is how do you correct for your own biases? There are certain things that I want to happen in the future, but I can't reliably make predictions if I don't acknowledge my own biases about I want a certain thing to happen, right? Yeah. I mean, I really, if you ask me, is Spider-Man going to come back to the Marvel Cinematic Universe? I'm going to say, I might say yes, and I don't know if I'm going to, it's probably not going to happen, but that's because I really want it to happen, right? So on more serious macro issues, how do you correct for your own biases in order to become a better futurist?
You know, what's interesting to me about that is that most of the prediction work that I do has to do with following the trajectory of the design of experiences and how, you know, kind of culture has evolved or how human experiences have evolved around different kinds of technology. So it's pretty easy in some ways to see a through line and be able to follow that through and see where that's going to go. But in a broader sense, when we think about sort of cultural trends and stuff that sort of sit around those technologies, what I find is interesting is that things happen in contradiction with one another. Like, you see trends that are contradictory. Like, you see things like the emergence of, you know, the Prius and the emergence of the Hummer a few years back as both big trends. And those kinds of things are all over the place. You get like, foodie culture kind of rose alongside some really throwback fast food stuff that was happening. So it's easy to correct for bias when you know that whatever it is that you want to have happen is probably going to be happening right alongside the thing that you don't want to have happen. As long as you're thinking about the dualistic nature of reality that way, I think it keeps you from getting too invested in believing in one outcome alone. Those things are always happening in these much more complex scenarios than we ever usually envision.
I like that. Well, speaking of envisioning things, I don't think that I envisioned this second version of our conversation to be even better than the first. But honestly, this was a pleasure. Kate O'Neill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And thank you all for listening once again. I told you she was fantastic, and I apologize. It took a little bit longer to get her on the show. My bad. But Yeah, as always, make sure to rate us, review us, subscribe, tell all of your friends, most of your friends. You always have to have at least one friend who doesn't know and will feel a little stupid. Make sure to keep the word going, because honestly, your feedback means a lot to us. And just to see those numbers go up every week really brings a tear of joy to my eye. And until next time, this is Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.